This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart, and coming up, a timely intervention by the World Mosquito Programme in New Caledonia with the French territory in the grip of a dengue fever outbreak. We look at the unhappy relationship between Hawaiians and the immigrant population from Micronesia. And with three Pacific Island nations on Canberra's list of shame for 2018, is it time to overhaul the rules surrounding diplomatic immunity? Those stories to come a little later, but first, the China factor, with Western nations like Australia and the United States apparently racing to outbid and outmaneuver Beijing, is set to dominate the Pacific agenda again in 2019. Chinese activity is centred on what President Xi Jinping has described as enlarging his country's circle of friends, or, put another way, persuading more nations to sign up to Mr. Xi's pet project, the infrastructure development strategy known as One Belt, One Road. But while the Western powers might be alarmed by China's inroads in the Pacific, a number of island leaders have taken it all in their stride and signed on the dotted line, eager to accept what the Chinese have to offer. However, as Yara Mary Atfield reports, the small print of the agreements can often be vague. So for those Pacific leaders who have reached a deal, exactly what have they signed up to?
The belt connects the land, the road moves on the sea.
In this colourful promotional video from 2017, which has been labelled broadly as propaganda, China makes its pitch for the Belt and Road. One Belt, One Road is China's economic and foreign policy strategy, with the official goal of linking Asia economically to Europe in two parts, through its overland Silk Road economic belt and its 21st century maritime Silk Road. It has a number of different aspects, but the South Pacific has always been identified as a key part of Beijing's maritime plans. Since that video was released, the list of countries signing up to the Belt and Road infrastructure plan has kept growing, and among other Pacific nations, it now includes Tonga, New Zealand and Vanuatu. However, when it was confirmed the government in Port Vila had signed a memorandum of understanding in November, Vanuatu's Foreign Minister, Ralph Reginvanu, wasn't able to provide many specifics.
It's very vague and it doesn't really commit us to anything except cooperation, and that's fine by us.
The ABC gained rare access to the MOU later that month, which revealed detail like a $70 million loan from China to upgrade roads and an agreement to forgive the debt from a 2004 loan worth almost $4 million. China's state media says more than 100 countries and international organisations have signed cooperation agreements since 2013. A deal with Tonga, another new signatory, came as China agreed to defer payments on around $160 million worth of loans for another 5 years. Peter Tsai is a non-resident fellow at the Lowy Institute, where he studies the Belt and Road, and he says China's President Xi Jinping is behind the push for the deals.
Belt and Road is by far the most important foreign policy goal he wants to promote. It's partially geopolitical, it's partially geoeconomical, it's partially promoting China's export of higher value goods.
Politicians in Australia have expressed alarm over suggestions the policy could lead to debt traps for poorer nations, but China maintains its spending is sincere and unselfish. Much of the cooperation comes off the back of MOUs, which Mr. Tsai says is nothing like the years of negotiation over careful wording that goes into other international trade or cooperation agreements.
It's just kind of a huge range. You can talk about something quite comprehensive as a kind of a China-Pakistan economic corridor, which has a lot of a quite detailed, fully worked out agreement about China-Pakistan. On the other end, you have something really quite vague, a really aspirational kind of a document.
The Australian state of Victoria has also signed up and made its MOU public in response to outrage from the federal government in Canberra. While the agreements all vary in their exact wording, they have many things in common, like references to cooperation and win-win partnerships. But in December, the Premier of Niue, Toki Talangi, told Pacific Beat the scope for his island is small.
We're interested in one thing, and that's preferential tax for our ship registry. Beyond that, there's nothing else that we particularly feel that we can contribute towards it.
So then what does China get out of it? Mr. Tsai says it's all about image.
It doesn't really mean much in terms of a practical effect. It just really gives the Chinese government a sense of a diplomatic, symbolic victory.
But he says although the wording of each MOU is different, they all do have substance.
There are specific obligations really around adopting the Chinese technologies for certain railway projects, the interest rate and etc. These are kind of a quite specific contractual obligation, so to speak.
Not all of the deals have been made public, but for those that have, nearly all have a clause either stating explicitly that the MOU has no legal weight or that it only expresses the common will of the signatories. Vanuatu's MOU, however, doesn't have such a clause, and while it isn't publicly available, the ABC understands that wording is absent from Tonga's document too.
That's Yara Murray-Atfield reporting. With the confirmation that New Caledonia is in the midst of yet another dengue fever outbreak, it is timely that the World Mosquito Programme is about to start a new initiative in the French Pacific Territory aimed at neutralising the insects that carry the dengue virus. In Papua New Guinea, meanwhile, a big concern has been a dramatic rise in the number of malaria cases. Against that background, the search for a vaccine and better treatments goes on. But as Lauren Belli reports, where dengue and also chikungunya are concerned, the scientists are making significant headway.
Pour lutter contre la dengue et le chikungunya, détruisons les gîtes larvaires.
People throughout the Pacific would be familiar with campaigns such as this one, encouraging people to turn over containers, fill up used tyres with soil, and clear out their drains to stop mosquitoes breeding and spreading viruses like dengue. For most, the disease is severely unpleasant, but for some, it can be deadly. In New Caledonia, there were 4,000 cases and 10 deaths from the disease between September 2016 and June the following year. Professor Cameron Simmons is the Director of Impact Assessment at the World Mosquito Programme.
A big public health problem for which existing methods of dengue control don't work sufficiently well to eliminate the problem. Mosquitoes have developed resistance to common insecticides. There's no dengue vaccine that's being used in the Pacific. And so we're really, really short of tools, and hence World Mosquito Program's Wolbachia method really fills an unmet need.
Wolbachia is a naturally occurring bacteria that prevents the transmission of viruses like dengue, chikungunya and Zika when it infects some mosquitoes. The World Mosquito Program releases the bacteria-carrying insects into the wild, which then breed with local populations until most of them carry Wolbachia. In 2019, the program will start in New Caledonia's capital, Noumea. Professor Simmons says they're seeing good results in the three other Pacific nations where they've established a program.
So far, so good. We've not seen dengue transmission occurring in locations where we've established Wolbachia, but I would say it's still very early days, and the cycle of dengue outbreaks through the Pacific, it's not a every year event. It tends to be one big year followed by one or two quiet years, and so really the full public health benefit of Wolbachia deployments we expect to be measurable over a period of 2 to 3 years.
But while Wolbachia is tackling some mosquito-borne diseases, others remain harder to beat. The World Health Organization's World Malaria Report noted that after an unprecedented period of success in controlling the disease, global progress has stalled. And the 2018 malaria survey from Papua New Guinea's Institute of Medical Research showed a dramatic increase in the country's malaria infections over the past few years, from 50,000 in 2014 to more than 430,000 in 2017. Dr. Leanne Robinson is a senior research fellow and was the Institute's head of the vector-borne diseases unit.
We did achieve substantial declines in cases and prevalence, but I think it becomes more difficult as time goes on from when those interventions are scaled up. And it's even more difficult again in countries where there's considerable challenges in terms of infrastructure and distribution of commodities and really maintaining a really strong health system and ensuring ready access to these kinds of interventions.
Professor Cameron Simmons says the science around using Wolbachia in mosquitoes that transmit malaria is still in its infancy.
Globally, there's around 45 different anopheles mosquitoes that can transmit the malaria parasite. And so that's 45 different mosquitoes potentially that you have to target to have a global impact on malaria. So that's a very challenging task.
For the moment, Dr. Robinson says health authorities should put renewed effort into control measures that have been proven to be effective.
I think it's really important to ensure that first and foremost, we have really strong coverage and importantly, uptake of the interventions that we already know work.
That's Dr. Leanne Robinson from Papua New Guinea's Institute of Medical Research, and the reporter there was Lauren Beldy. Researchers examining healthcare provision for Micronesian patients in Hawaii have found they face discrimination from providers and often struggle with linguistic and cultural barriers when seeking medical help. One example in the recently published report by the team from the University of Hawaii and the College of Micronesia points to people from Chuuk and the Federated States of Micronesia sometimes being subjected to medical procedures they don't want or even understand. And as Bill Bainbridge reports, these latest findings have come at the end of a year that saw Micronesians pushing back with an online campaign drawing attention to the degree of racism they experience in Hawaii.
Kathy Jetnell-Kitchener is a Marshallese poet who shot to international prominence with her poetry performance at the opening of the United Nations Climate Summit in New York in 2014. She's also tackled the issue of anti-Micronesian racism in her poem Lessons from Hawaii.
Lesson number 4. I'll tell you why everyone here hates us Micronesians. It's because we're neon-coloured skirts screaming different! Different like that ESL kid whose name you can't pronounce, whose accent you can't miss. Different like 7-Eleven, Walmart...
The issue is not new, but gained international attention when writer and activist Sha Ongolengol, a Palauan American living in Hawaii, launched the Being Micronesian hashtag to highlight the problem of discrimination and other institutional barriers faced by Micronesians living in the United States.
It includes screenshots of people making derogatory comments about how Micronesian people dress, to calls for a purge and hunting Micronesians and ethnic cleansing. It's ugly.
The stories were all too familiar to journalist Anita Hofschneider.
Back in 2011, I had come to Hawaii for a summer internship at a local nonprofit, and it involved doing research on immigrant communities here. And so one of the first things we did was go to the Marshallese Consul General's office. And I remember being very shocked to see a sign that was stuck on the fence, and in red letters, it said, "Kill all Micronesians." And when my colleague took the sign and brought it inside the office, she was told to add it to a pile. And so it seemed like this was something that had happened not infrequently there.
And what do you think the origin of those kind of attitudes is?
Just like any place, there's always tensions with new immigrants. And the relationship between COFA nations, which is the nations under the Compact of Free Association treaties, Palau, the Marshall Islands, and the Federated States of Micronesia, and the United States, is very complicated. What people often don't hear about are the people from those countries who are contributing and paying taxes to the state. They often don't hear about the national security value that the U.S. receives from having access to the land and water in those islands.
Micronesians from those COFA nations have residency rights but not citizenship, and their access to benefits such as health and education in the US is limited. Anita Hofschneider has tried to explain issues affecting people from COFA nations in her journalism.
After we published our articles, I got an email from a woman who said that nothing we write will ever change the racism and hatred she feels for Micronesians. But on the other hand, I've heard from people who say that what I wrote about reminded them of the racism they experienced as they were growing up. They were Samoan or they were Filipino, and they remember being bullied as a kid in Hawaii.
She says while the Micronesian community in Hawaii is concerned with hate speech online, it's more practical issues that still take precedence.
One of the larger challenges than just dealing with hate speech online is Micronesian immigrants have a host of institutional barriers to success in Hawaii. For example, they're not eligible for Medicaid and food stamps. And it's not just in Hawaii, in the U.S. And so when I talk to different advocates in the communities, they're pretty used to this online hate speech. And their bigger concerns are things like being able to get driver's licenses that last longer than a year and being able to fix some of these broader public policy challenges that they feel really make it difficult to succeed in America.
Hawaii-based journalist Anita Hofschneider ending that report from Bill Bainbridge. I'm Richard Hewitt, and you're listening to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. Well, just like last year, 2019 will feature two critical votes in the Pacific, with a general election in Solomon Islands, and nearly 20 years after the Bougainville conflict came to an end, there will be a referendum there on the independence question. And more broadly, the one-time colonial power in the region, the United Kingdom, will press ahead with their re-engagement in the Pacific. So, to put matters in context, I turn to political analyst Tess Newton-Kane from TNC Pacific Consulting, who says the first and by no means easy task in Bougainville will be to ensure that the referendum actually goes ahead as planned.
I think there's always potential for key moments like this, especially a referendum of this sort, to be flashpoints for contestation or competition. And given the tragic history about Bougainville, there will be concerns around security and whether this referendum can be held peacefully. We've seen very recently reports coming from different parts of Bougainville that communities are describing themselves as referendum ready. We've seen some quite significant reconciliation ceremonies being held, including some further surrender of firearms. So I think that's all reason to feel positive. There's a lot to get done before June the 15th, which is when this referendum is penciled in to take place. And certainly I've heard from people that are closer to what's going on in Bougainville than I am, that there is an expectation that that date may shift a little bit. But certainly everyone seems very confident that it will be held this year.
If the date were to shift, though, wouldn't that further raise suspicion that Port Moresby will do whatever it can to, quote unquote, try and derail the referendum? Because clearly they don't want Bougainville to vote for independence. And yet the suggestion is there's likely to be exactly that.
If the date were to shift, it will depend on who pushes for that. And if it's seen as being something that's driven by Port Moresby, then obviously that's going to be quite concerning and may form a point of conflict. If it's something that the ABG pushes for because it wants to make sure that things are ready and that the referendum can be held in the best possible circumstances, then it may be that it won't be so much of an issue. There's an awful lot going on in Bougainville at the moment around concerns about transfers of funding from Waigani to the Bougainville government. That's a long-standing concern. There are additional concerns around possible mismanagement of funding and bringing in fraud squad detectives to investigate possible misappropriation of funding. So it's a very complex environment. It's always complex on Bougainville, but it's particularly complex at the moment. And everybody needs to feel ready for this referendum when it takes place. And in terms of what Port Moresby wants, the legislation around the Bougainville referendum is slightly unusual and possibly further complicated by the fact that regardless of what the result is, the government of Papua New Guinea has the final say on whether that result is accepted.
Another election which is looming, well, a referendum in Bougainville's case, an election in the case of Solomon Islands. And whenever there is an election anywhere in the Pacific, the question of corruption, let's face it, is never very far away. But I'm wondering whether this election in the Solomons could be different. I mean, we've seen a number of prominent politicians arrested in recent times and accused of corruption. There's been a real crackdown on voter corruption and trying to tidy up the roll and make sure that everybody who is entitled to vote does vote, votes in the proper place and only votes once. So could this be a bit of a first?
I think it is significant for Solomon Islands. There have been some long-standing issues along the lines of what you've said. And certainly my understanding from colleagues in Solomon Islands is that there is an expectation that the conduct and the results of these elections will be quite different because of the legislative changes that have been made in relation to the electoral laws. And another one that's quite significant is that electoral laws now mean that any challenge to a result has to be decided by the courts within 12 months of the date of the election, which is quite significant because in Solomon Islands, we've had electoral disputes going so long that these decisions are being made in the 12 months in the lead up to the next election. So restricting the time period in which those electoral disputes can be heard will also be significant for what happens further to the elections. And obviously it does have an implication in terms of workload for the courts.
The re-engagement by the United Kingdom. Might some people see this as a bit of, I don't know, quasi-colonialism? Or is there something more genuine to this sudden re-emergence of the UK in the Pacific after so many years?
It's something that analysts in Beijing are watching quite closely. Certainly it's possible to frame it in terms of revisiting colonialism. Generally from conversations that I've had in the Pacific, it seems to be welcomed that the UK is going to be more present with new high commissions being opened and old high commissions being reopened, which is the case in Vanuatu, which was a specific request from the president of Vanuatu to Prince Charles when he visited in April of 2018. So there does seem to be a sense that at some level there is residual nostalgia and a residual affection for British involvement in the region. And so that would seem to be something that they will be able to play to. I think there's also an element of this being something about a conversation that the UK wants to have with itself about its relevance and its place in the world further to whatever happens at the end of March in relation to Brexit.
Tess Newton-Cain, principal of TNC Pacific Consulting, with some analysis on the political year ahead in the Pacific. Finally, former Australian diplomat Richard Brunofsky is calling for a review of the diplomatic immunity system, which he says in some cases can offer unnecessary and unjustified protection. His comment comes in light of the annual List of Shame released in Canberra, detailing which embassies in the Australian capital owe the most in unpaid parking fines. Russia tops the list by some distance, but three Pacific Island countries, Tonga, Samoa and Fiji, are also guilty of failing to pay fixed penalties. Mr. Brunofsky blames a combination of ignorance and arrogance, but with immunity rules as they stand, he says there is not a lot the Australian authorities can do to get what they're owed.
They go about it by trying to convince the embassies concerned that they owe it to being responsible diplomats to have their staff pay their fines. But the problem is, you see, there's reciprocity involved. If we crack down on these wayward diplomats and force them to pay the fines, not that we can, but if we really put pressure on the embassies concerned would go back to Home Office and say, all right, we'll be reciprocal here and you can do the same to Australian diplomats in your countries. Not that Australian diplomats are given to flouting the laws. We're told very strictly before we go overseas, under the conventions, you have diplomatic immunity for your official acts, but don't disgrace us. Don't take anything for granted. Behave very carefully.
The largest number of unpaid fines, apparently, are those they know were involving diplomats, but they don't know which embassies they're attached to.
I find that very hard to believe. Diplomatic number plates are known to foreign affairs, to protocol, which embassies they belong to. Therefore, they can easily trace the number plate. One of the problems we have, though, is the policemen in the ACT are very loath to enforce these fines. If they find a diplomat over the limit for alcohol, they can prosecute, they can send it to DFAT and say something has to be done about this. This guy was driving under the influence and is dangerous to the public. And then it's up to protocol to approach the embassy concerned. The embassy will say, well, yes, we'll do something about it and give their diplomat a stern lecture or not. It depends on the embassy. It depends on the country that's being represented in Australia.
Does this tell us, albeit, I guess, a small part of the whole, that maybe the issue of diplomatic immunity needs to be revisited, or is that just too complicated because it's obviously on an international scale?
No, I think it could be revisited if this becomes such a problem that diplomats in a wholesale way are flouting the law. The whole point of having diplomatic immunity is that it allows men and women of their country to come into another country and represent them without fear of local attack or local illegality. They have to do their job, and their job involves that. It's a very clear principle, and it has to be obeyed. But traffic and traffic fines and irresponsible driving could, I believe, be excised from diplomatic immunity. You have to go back to the conventions and see how it's done, but I think that's probably a very valuable idea. If enough countries feel that foreign diplomats are flouting their laws and therefore putting in jeopardy and the safety of their citizens, something might be done about it. It's something that the United Nations should consider.
But supposing the rules were changed, I mean, if we look at countries in our own backyard that have been involved in some of these unpaid fines, Tonga, Samoa, Fiji are on the list. I mean, the idea, for example, of a police officer perhaps marching into the Fijian embassy and trying to arrest somebody for unpaid parking fines, it could be quite difficult, couldn't it?
Well, that's been quite dramatic. I don't think you'd have a policeman marching into an embassy. What you'd have is the clear understanding on the part of the head of mission of that embassy that this is not part of diplomatic immunity, and therefore they'd have to be susceptible to receive summonses for the diplomat concerned to go to court.
Ultimately, though, is it a case that those responsible for collecting these fines look at these figures and probably look at them with some degree of despair, anticipating, I suspect, that most of this money they'll never see?
Look, I'm not in the mind of the chief of protocol right now in DFAT in Canberra, but I can imagine he or she is constantly aware of the problem. I don't know whether they regularly make representations to embassies concerned. I bet they've got a hit list. I bet they've got a list of the embassies whose diplomats are the worst offenders. And when they do, I've no doubt they would send letters occasionally. My wife used to be in protocol many years ago, and she said that they were always aware of this and were always trying to make representations. But whether they are followed or not depends very much on the embassies concerned.
Do you think one possible solution might be to start clamping cars?
Yeah, all right. if you want to see that. And then the embassy that's clamped goes back to Home Office and said, hey, we've lost our cars. They've been clamped. Better crack down on the Aussies for doing the same thing.
Former Australian diplomat and immediate past president of the Australian Institute of International Affairs, New South Wales, Richard Bronowski, rounding out this edition of Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart, and as always, thank you very much for listening.